Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Professor Tucker, Professor Grimm, two very old friends, we're doing yeoman service at this august university, that junior partner of where I come from, Harvard, but nevertheless accepted as such a major center of learning in the field of religion and nature. I'm very glad to be able to accept the invitation of the Muslim students to this conference. I fell ill 2-3 weeks ago. I said jokingly that don't say there is no democracy in the world. There's one kind of democracy, which is perfect democracy. The spread of germs on airplanes. And I was traveling in first class. There was nobody there. It was all by myself. But once I landed, that was the end of me. I was worried that I would not be able to come here to be with you. But thank God, here I am to give you a headache for the next hour. I'm going to speak for about an hour. And then I will give you a chance to ask questions if you wish. I'll get to the questions. I'll go and try to sit down. I've had open heart surgery. I'm told not to stand up for too long. But the question of nature, of the environment, has been at the heart of my life for so many decades that no matter what happens, I try to give my best to it. Evelyn was kind enough to allude to certain events in my own life, which turned my interest towards the study of the environment at a time when no one spoke about it. But for the sake of history and the fact that this is an Islamic critical appraisal of the relationship between spirituality and nature, the title of this conference, very briefly I want to point out a few facts which came together in my life and which made me turn my attention to this field long before anybody else did, at least in my own generation. I was brought up in a family in which we spent the summers by the great Mount Damavan, the beautiful conic mountain like Mount Fuji, but much higher, the highest mountain in Western Asia, one of the most beautiful places in the world, every summer. And therefore I had a very intimate relationship with nature from childhood, which is extremely significant in my own development and worldview. And I always wanted to be alone in nature with God. I always felt the presence of God in nature. And my mother bawled me out all the time, why don't you go and play with other children? That's not what I wanted to do. I wanted to be alone under the trees and the hills and the mountains by myself. And now, because of my heart, I cannot mountain climb, but I used to be a very good mountain climber. I've climbed many of the most beautiful peaks in my own home country, Iran, and a few in the Alps in the old days, but not anymore. But I had this immediate relationship with nature before its rational and scientific element came in. And then this was combined with a gift which God had given me from childhood for mathematics and philosophy, both of which interested me a great deal and caused me to go, especially at Penny, where I received the highest grades in the National American Math Exam in Princeton. And everybody thought I should be the mathematician or a physicist to go into the field of physics. And I discovered many, many years later that I wanted to be what Parmenides wanted to be, a physicos. If you read Parmenides, the great Greek philosopher, he says that I am a physicos, that is a person who seeks to understand the nature of reality, of physical reality. I thought that's what physics was going to do for me. So I entered MIT. I was the first in my class in the middle of a very good, you might say, academic career for this world. Everything suddenly turned upside down. And I realized that this was not for me, that physics was not going to discover the nature of reality. And although I was continuing to study both physics and mathematics, I turned to the study of Oriental philosophies. I met the library of Ananda Kumaraswamy, who had died shortly before that, and spent hours and hours and into the night, because I knew Mrs. Kumaraswamy, in studying a Hindu text, Chinese text, and of course my own Islamic tradition. I had a very strong background as a child in Persian and Quranic studies. My father was one of the great scholars of Iran. I knew 1,000 verses of Persian poetry when I was 10 years old. That was not lost. But I turned to Oriental, the Orient beyond the east of Persia itself, and I was following this pattern together, and continued my great intense love for nature. I would go into the woods, into the Berkshires, or sometimes New Hampshire, oftentimes alone, all by myself. And the Walden Pond, to which Evelyn pointed out, often have at 12 o'clock at night, I would drive to Walden Pond. There was nobody there. This is the pond about which Thoreau wrote his one of his classical works of the environment. It was full of bottles, broken bottles, and ash tray broken like this, and plastic. It was very, very sad to see it. That made a very bad impression upon me. And I was followed by the making of Route 128, the Belt Road, around Boston, which cut off the life, that is, of deer and other animals from the hinterland of Concord and other places into Arlington, where I was living. And I suddenly realized there's something seriously wrong. Intellectually, I'd realized something was very seriously wrong. That's why I was turning to fields other than science, but I decided that there was something. There was going to be an environmental crisis. Nature was being threatened. At that time, the only book that people were reading was Rachel Carson's book, Silent Spring. The Christian theologians spoke not one iota about the environment. This was not part of the program. One man, one Anglican priest, had written something in 1943 which touched upon the environment, but it was not part of the mainstream of Christian thought or Jewish thought at all, or Islamic thought whatsoever. And the scientists were not at all aware of this, nor interested in this. Nobody ever thought that the applications of modern science would cause the death of the very subject that modern science was studying. At that time, nobody believed such a thing. They thought there was going to be an infinite amount of application of modern technology. But for me, this malaise was existential. I felt that something very serious was going to happen. And I changed my life completely. I left Harvard. I was offered to stay there, or at MIT. I turned both of them down, went back to Iran. And I found completely deaf ears. Iran, which was a great intellectual center of Islamic civilization for centuries, deaf ears when it came to the question of the environment. I remember when I was only in my 20s, I'd just become associate professor of philosophy at Tehran University. I gave a talk at the Iranian National Radio about the importance of the environment. Nobody listened to it. I would talk to the great ulama in Qom, with whom I was studying traditional philosophy. I said, look what Mullah Sadr says about nature. They couldn't connect. They could not connect what our traditional philosophers or Jalaluddin Rumi, others said about nature with what was going on. And it was the beginning of the modernization and industrialization of Iran. Pollution was just beginning to appear in Tehran. You could still see Mount Damavand. Now you can't see your aunt's house from nearby, but in those days, it was just the beginning of these events, and Cairo and Karachi and the city just were beginning to become polluted. You cannot imagine what Cairo was like in 1945 when the young boy visited it. Those of you who visited it, I just cannot imagine what was happening. But that's exactly the time when this was happening in these cities, and there was no interest among Islamic thinkers at all. I spent 2 decades in Iran. I wrote a lot. I founded new institutions. I made a humble contribution to Islamic philosophy, to Islamic studies, to combative religion. But when it came to this question of man and the environment, I really found a deaf ear. And it was the hands of destiny that what I could do in Iran was the only thing I've ever done practically in this realm. And that is that I was able to get the ear of the king and the brother of the king, who was a hunter. I said to him, please stop killing all the beautiful animals. Why don't you try to preserve them if you love them? You know, hunters also have a side that is based on love of nature, but it's a very peculiar attitude to have towards the environment. Anyway, finally, we were, with the help of the authorities in Iran, the highest political authorities, were able to establish the first national park system in the whole of Asia, in Iran. Not the first Islamic country, but the first country in Asia which created a national park system. And that, alhamdulillah, was by minor contribution, but not intellectually. Nobody was interested in listening to this. Meanwhile, while I was at the American University of Beirut, John Rust, who was a major professor of chemistry at the University of Chicago, was sent by Mircea Eliade, who was a friend of mine, a famous professor of religion, to come to Beirut to meet me, so I would accept to give a series of lectures on the environment in relation to man. Eliade understood that. Eliade was a person that understood traditional cosmologies, that discussed these things together with him, with Corbin, and Eliade asked if I would come and do it. I said, yes, I will come. I spent the summer of 1965 in the Wardner Library. All those Latin notes you see in this book and so forth were not from Tehran University Library. They are rare works which alluded to this, but the idea was already in my mind. And I delivered the Rockefeller Series lecture at the University of Chicago, which were followed 6 months later by the very famous essay of Lynn White, The Historical Root of Our Ecological Crisis. I preceded him by 6 months, but being a Muslim, I was totally ignored completely in the Western discussion of the environmental crisis. Non-existent, but it doesn't matter. What is important is that God sees, not what his creatures see. So I don't care about that at all. But I'm really trying to clear the ground for you as far as the history is concerned of what happened, especially in the Islamic world. Gradually in the 1970s, a few voices began to be heard in the Islamic world, many of them my own students. First of all, in Turkey, one or two of them in Pakistan, one or two people in Morocco, very rare, one or two here and there, who began to become interested in this aspect of my writings. At that time, there was not a single other Muslim writer who was writing on the environment, not one person. But since my writings were so well known, people were saying, well, what is he saying in this book? We understand what he's saying about Ibn Sina or Sohrawardi, but what about this question of the environment? And gradually the seed was sown in the 1970s. In the 1980s, the environmental crisis began to hit home in the Islamic world. And it hit at the same time, of course, that other non-Western societies were destroying their environment as well. Half of all the forests of the Himalayas have been cut. And that was 10 years ago. I don't know what's going on now. Perhaps our Indian friends can tell us. 10 years ago, when I visited India, the environmentalists told me half of all the trees of the Himalayas have been cut. And you know what's going on in China. I just heard a few people making comments, one among the great catastrophes of history, besides the Yangtze and the pollution and everything else. But anyway, gradually this very stupid attitude of non-Western world or non-industrial world countries that said, oh, while you were polluting the Hudson and the Thames and getting rich, we didn't say anything. Now it's our turn to pollute. Our rivers say, don't do it. We're going to pollute. We don't care what happens. Our people need to get wealthy. This kind of argument, which is a kind of suicidal argument, was very, very prevalent. If you spoke to any president or king or somebody else, whether leftist or rightist, this was the argument. And I have said in several places, in fact, I said it in the first Earth Day that was held in Stockholm in 1970, which Morris Strong, that remarkable Canadian visionary, put on, and he asked me to help him. I had a minor role in this. I was one of the three people who gave a keynote address. I said, there's only one thing in which all humanity agrees on, and that's the destruction of nature. And I alluded to the Islamic world itself, whether you have a monarchy, a republic, a leftist, a rightist government, it doesn't matter. They all agree on the destruction of nature. There's no exception. There's no single government in the Islamic world which supports sane environmental policies. I was brave enough to say that in Stockholm. I said that in Tehran, and since then I've said it in many places, including in Turkey. I gave a very, very strong talk. At this point in my life, I'm the end of my life, what do I want to get promotion to? I don't need promotion anything. May God promote me in the next world. I don't need any more promotion in this world. So I'm frank. I don't beat around the bush. And because of my own position in life, I've met people of the highest authority politically with whom I could actually engage in this matter. But it's remarkable how in the Islamic world this kind of attitude cut across different political views, even religious views. The Islamic Republic of Iran, which should have come in the name of Islam, which should first of all have promulgated the Islamic view of nature, continued exactly the same program as before when it came to this question. Their attitude to technology did not change one iota. I was the president for several years of the Muslim world's number one technical university, the Sharif University. And they're the same ones who are now doing the nuclear energy, which I tried to stop when I was in Iran, president of the university. Didn't succeed, but I tried very hard. The same people. No, the attitude did not change. Until the 80s, as I said, the pollution, different problems that were coming about, illnesses that the governments had to face, gradually changed the attitude. I remember one day I was sitting in my office. I, who am exiled from Iran, my house was plundered, all my property was lost, my library, many books written, all disappeared, all of these things. I was sitting in my office and somebody called me up. He said, Mr. Rafsanjani, who was then president of Iran, is giving a lecture on the environment. Could you please prepare a text for him? I laughed. I said, I will not prepare a text for Rafsanjani, but this fellow was a friend of mine. I'll prepare some pages for you. You can do whatever you like with it. And so things gradually began to change. Even Saudi Arabia, which has done the greatest traversy in Islamic history to Islam by the destruction of Mecca and the creation of these environmentally suicidal 100-story buildings around the house of God. I don't know how they can sleep, how they expect to die, having done that. Even Saudi Arabia began to realize that they have to do something for the environment, and they went to the idea of Hema and the idea the Prophet had promulgated of a sanctuary. I'm sure one of the young scholars who spoke today have referred to it. Sanctuaries where wildlife would be protected, to bring that idea back and so forth. Even Saudi Arabia, which has no understanding of Islamic art, no understanding of Islamic architecture, I mean, there are people in it, but that way of thinking, and certainly not of Islamic philosophy, which teaches my books on Islamic science in its universities, but my books on Islamic philosophy are all banned in Saudi Arabia. As if one could understand Avicenna without understanding his philosophy. But this is, even Saudi Arabia began to have some programs, and now that we are in the year 2011, there are some hopeful signs. But it goes no more than that. No more than that, and I want to devote the time I have, the rest of the time that I have, to discuss with you once again, the principles of the Islamic understanding of the environment and why it has to be so radical and iconoclastic in order for it to have effect. Many of you here, I was sitting back there for an hour before I came to speak. I did not hear the morning talks, but many people talk about, and it's fine, I'm not against it, it's fine, about, let's say, aspects of the Sharia dealing with the environment, with the right of animals, with plants, with trees, cutting of trees, with pollution of water. These are very, very important matters. I do not at all doubt that. But there's something more important than that, and that is the worldview which allows these things to take place. And my belief is that we have to radically reject the worldview upon which all these acts are based. And we do not do that. We do not have enough Muslim intellectuals who either have the courage or the knowledge to be able to critically reappraise modern Western science, the paradigm upon which it is based, and to reject that in favor of an Islamic paradigm of knowledge in which the world of nature and knowledge of nature will have another meaning. My thesis has not changed one iota since the 1950s, that there's no way to avoid the environmental crisis without the resacralization of nature. It isn't that nature is desacralized, it's that nature is desacralized for us, because we have become desacralized within ourselves. We cannot add the quality of the sacred to nature. That's given by God. One of God's name is Quddus, Malik al-Quddus in the Quran, the sacred. And the quality of Quds, Qadasa, belongs to the divine essence. It's one of the supreme names of God. So who are we to sacralize nature? That's just a metaphorical way of speaking. It is to realize once again the sacred quality of nature. Until we do that, it's like having the dragon loose and fire coming out of its mouth and burning people, and we run around putting ointment on the burns. That's fine, but somebody has to slay the dragon. You need St. George to slay the dragon. Those people who are putting on ointments on the burns, alhamdulillah, that's fine. There's something much deeper that needs to be done, and that, as it has not been done in the Islamic world, no more than it has been done in the Hindu world, or not to tell the Chinese world, this world which was based on the Taoist and Confucian view of nature, and the antithesis came into being with the Marxist regime, but there are also even within China, including my very dear friend and comrade with Professor Tucker Tu Weiming, with whom I've had hour-long discussions, including a talk I gave in Beijing last year on this issue, about this matter. Even in China, even within China, there's some appraisal and awareness of this. But by and large, the great non-Western traditions, whose sacred and spiritual perspective on nature was present, since the process of modernization in those worlds has been shorter, have not suffered as much as the Western traditions have. To rediscover the Christian view of a sacred view of nature is not impossible. There are not many Protestant Catholic theologians writing about these things. But it's much more difficult to dig from underneath a great deal of debris of several centuries of a totally opposite view of what nature is. But if you're a Hindu, or a Taoist, or a Muslim, you don't have to go too far back in your history to remember, actually, a world which was sacred, in a sense, not divine necessarily. Some Salafi Muslims will say, oh, you said nature is sacred, only God is sacred. Only God is divine. No, there's nowhere where the Quran says that things are not sacred. Who can show me that? In fact, the Quran says, wherever you turn, there's the face of God. Wherever you turn, there's the face of God. Here I'm turning. This is humanly made. It's not certain that's the face of God, but in God's nature, what God has created, the divine face, which is His tajalli, His faith, His grace, His presence is always there. And so this is not something that is theologically anathema. But turn to the Islamic world. The major problem for us, I'll leave the Hindu and the Chinese world aside for the moment. The major problem for us, because this is a conference on, as most of you are young Muslim thinkers or scholars, and our hopes are in you. I'm at the end of the road. You're the people who must carry the torch now. In the Islamic world, you've had many important schools of thought, which are very important, but their function was not to deal with the sacred quality of nature. Fine. Schools of fiqh, of kalam, you will not find any help in Ash'ari or Baghlani or Fakhruddin Razi on this issue. I've dealt with many, many other important issues, or in the books of the Sharia, except concerning the huquq of other creatures, which is very important, because here the word haq is related to the word law, and each creature, according to Islamic law, has its own right, has its own haq, has its own due, which must be observed, because it cannot obliterate the huquq of other creatures. It's not only human beings, but all of God's creatures. We cannot do that. That's a Sharia responsibility. But the philosophical foundation which we're seeking must be sought in the Islamic intellectual tradition, in either Islamic philosophy and metaphysics, or in Sufism, or in the sapiental commentaries on the Quran, and most of all on the Quran itself. The Quran, of all the sacred scriptures, the only possible exception is the Tao Te Ching. It speaks more about nature than any other scripture. That the only exception is about this par, I would say, with the Tao Te Ching, the sacred scripture of Taoism. But there are more verses in the Quran about nature than there is in the Old Testament, in the New Testament, in the Avesta, in the Upanishads, many of the great sacred scriptures of other religions of the world. And the Quran, it is almost addresses itself to not only us, but to the whole of creation. God swears by the sun and the moon. Ash-shamsu wal-qamar speaks about revelation to bees. It speaks about the heavenly pomegranate, the rumman. Its description of paradise are full of natural beauty. They are not abstract. They are concrete images of which the images of nature are reflections. Not that those are naturalistic, as Western Orientalists say, it's just the reverse. I have the shoe on the wrong foot. But this is Yale, unfortunately, one of the places where some people wear shoes on the wrong foot. But we won't get into that. Some people, I said. Those people here who do this know what I'm talking about. None of them is here, so they don't have to worry. But Anyway, from the Islamic point of view, the description is Surah Ar-Rahman of paradise. It's not because Islam is naturalistic. It's because all of the beauties of nature are themselves reflections of paradisal realities. Therefore, the Quran itself, if we were not blinded by our education, by our short-sightedness, of course, by our own egos, by the fact that we live on the surface of our being and therefore cannot see anything but the surface of things, if we're not blinded by these things, we would not even need to go to Ibn Arabi and Rumi and Mullah Sadr and Sohrawardi and other people to have a colossal philosophy of nature developed. But unfortunately, this is necessary. If this were not so, there would not have been need for a Quranic commentary in any field. The Quran would have sufficed. And this is a very great danger that is facing a lot of Muslims in this country. You have 6 billion Muslims and 6 million schools of Islamic thought, because each person goes to the Quran, picks it up, and thinks it can interpret it as it wills. Putting aside the tradition, the commentaries, and everything else, of course, that is not acceptable, certainly from a person like myself who is a traditionalist, who respects the complete tradition of all traditions, including our own. So anyway, the Quran itself is the foundation which allows a very profound philosophy of nature to be developed. Somebody suggests this is a new way of thinking. In a way, yes, in a way, no. If the Quran did not address itself to every generation, it would not be the word of God in its infinity. It would be terminated. So the Quran has to speak to every generation. And there are parts of the Quran which, in fact, were always there, but did not have to be applied all the time. For example, the question of the plurality of religions. The plurality of religions was not an existential issue, even in Ottoman Turkey, where there were a lot of Christians and Jews, and some Zoroastrians even in Eastern Anatolia, that it is today existential for any man or woman of religion. And it's a question of the environment. When in the Surah Al-Baqarah, the devil, Satan actually, tells God that this man, creature you have created, thou hast created, that is man, is going to bring fasad upon the earth. And the idea of mufsid, corrupter of the earth, mufsidun fil ard, and all of these statements, this was attributed for centuries to being oppressors, politically, economically, socially, morally, and so forth. People didn't have to worry about whole rivers being polluted, the earth being polluted. But the Quran says, mufsiduna fil ard, corruptors of the earth. So obviously that means it's also there. God had put it there for us to use at a moment when we need to use it. A corruptor of the earth is not only someone who commits adultery, but it's someone who also destroys a tree, destroys a river. And Islamic ethics does not only apply to human beings, it's also cosmic ethics, if correctly understood. Our attitude towards God's creation. It reminds me that they have the idea of the sacred earth in the Quran. That's right. Of course, they're both as-samawat wal-ard are sacred. And of course, the idea of the Holy Land is the Quranic term. The Holy Earth, it comes from the Quran, doesn't come from the Bible. Thank you very much. See, my students are so courageous that they try to correct the middle of a lecture. That's a good sign in traditional Islamic learning. A good talibah, a good student, in the middle of the discourse of teaching, we said, "Amma walakin," and they want to say something. So, I don't mind. Thank you very much. Yes, the earth is sacred, as the Quran says, and everything is sacred. And the Quran opens the door to this understanding of our relation to other creatures in the sense that we are not an island unto ourselves. Even consciousness, even worship of God, of religion, is more than a human affair. كُلُّ شَيْءٍ يُسَبِّحُ بِحَمْدِهِ, the Quran says. All things hymn the praise of God. Not some things, not only human beings. We are not the only creatures. Everything hymns the praise of God. And on the basis of that, the Islamic thinkers over the centuries developed this very, very important idea of the cosmic Quran and the written or mudawwan or was really means put together Quran, the written Quran, the Quran that we have that Muslims carry in their pockets or read. This is a very key term for recreating a new awareness of the Islamic understanding of nature. All of these things I'm saying is with that goal in mind. And how do we do it from elementary school through television programs that come into every home? That's for another program. I cannot deal with everything at the same time. But I'm presenting what I consider to be absolutely essential for the Islamic community as a whole. The first thing is to resuscitate this idea that the Quran, which is for us the Word of God, is not only revealed to human beings, it's also revealed to nature. And in fact, it has a cosmic aspect. The first revelation of God is the cosmos. The first revelation of God is the cosmos. After that come those series of revelations understood in human language. And that's why we have Al-Qur'an al-Takwini, Al-Qur'an al-Tadwini in Arabic, which there are many advanced students here, Islamic studies, they all know very well. Some of you don't know Arabic, I don't want to burden you too heavily with Arabic terms, but it's a very, very key and important terms. And they're considered, both of these, to be in a sense reflections of the prototypic, archetypal Qur'an, which is in the Lawhul Mahfud, the guarded tablet. The guarded tablet upon which God wrote His word, as the Quran says. And these are not at all later inventions. They are elements which are within the Quran itself, which has sustained the Islamic community for centuries. And one of the greatest tragedies that befallen the Islamic world is that at the very moment where we're most need of these sources, in the name of Islam, many deny the significance of these sources. That is, we are narrowing our gauge at the very time when we need to lengthen it and widen it. And there are people, I've talked to many people, are belong to Wahhabi Salafi background, so all of this is just some Shiite speculation. I'm not speaking here as a Shiite. I'm speaking here as a student of Islam. And I challenge anyone who's a Sunni, who knows the Sunni intellectual tradition, to say, no, this is not the case, because there are so many Sunni writers that deal with Shiism alone. Yes, there are some Shiite writers who have written about it, and there are some Shiite writers who are not interested in this at all, as well as Sunni writers. It's not that it's not just a monopoly of one side at all, by any means. Another very, very important point, which I've alluded to over and over again in my lectures, in my writings, but now I want to deal with a bit more of a practical aspect of it, is the fact that it's not accidental by any means that in Arabic the verses of the Quran and the phenomena of nature have the same name, same word, ayah. Ayah. The phenomena of nature are ayat. The Quran says explicitly, سَنُّرِهُمْ آيَاتِنَا فِي الْآفَاقِ وَفِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَا لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ, that we shall show them our signs, ayat, both upon the horizons in the cosmos and within themselves, until it becomes certain unto them that is the truth. This is chapter 33 of the Quran. So the word ayah is not only a sign but symbol. Everything in the world attests to divinity, both within our souls and in the world out there. And that the consciousness of that is made possible by that third kind of ayah, which is the Quran. The ayah of the Quran makes us aware of ourselves being ayat and the world of nature being ayat. I always say, joking to my students, that when I was in Iran, before the Iran Revolution, there were five or six ayatollahs, I know all of them. Now, there are hundreds of ayatollahs all over the place, many of whom were my classmates, and I don't know how they got to be ayatollahs. But I said, however, don't worry, we're all ayatollahs in this class. In fact, by virtue of existing, we are signs of God. So look at all the Ayatollahs sitting before me. Oh, I must salute. So the word ayah is a key term to be resuscitated as something which binds the agent, the observer, the subject, which is the human being. That two-legged creature is destroying the world. And the object, which is the world, and the source of both the subject and the object, which is divinity, was created, both the object, which is the world, and the subject, which is the human being. They're all bound together by this term, ayah and ayat. Now, what has happened to us, not only in the West, but now more and more in the Islamic world, is two reductions which have gone parallel with each other, and they've been devastating. One is the reduction of the knowing agent of the human being to the least common denominator, you might say, or the lowest level, the psychophysical level. And secondly, the reduction of nature to its lowest level, which is the quantitative, observable, empirical level. Denial of both the higher levels of nature, its symbolic content, and even higher orders of reality, and denial of higher orders of consciousness within human beings, by virtue of which we could know those higher levels of reality of nature. So, in a sense, this reductionism has worked on both the subject and the object. And by being veiled, that is, the human being veiled from his own higher consciousness or inner recesses of the soul, we also see the world out there is veiled. It is one of the most beautiful poems of the Persian language, one of my favorite. Once you invite the Persian, you have to bear one moment for at least one Persian poem. Jalaluddin Rumi says, Kashki hasti zabani dashti ta zahastan pardaha bardashti. That's an unbelievable poem. Kashki hasti zabani dashti تازه هستان پرده ها برداشتی. Let me translate it for you. I could have translated it out of my head, but I translated it on purpose to be a little bit more literary. If only existence had a tongue, so that they could lift the veil from existing things. That is, all creatures have a tongue with which they praise God, but we can't hear it. There's a veil that hides it, and therefore is as if they're tongueless. Rumi says in another poem, on day of judgment, you shall hear the voice of God, of God's creatures, but you cannot do so now. This is a very, very important matter for us to bring back to life. And in order to bring this back to life, the idea that we're living in a world which is not only created sometimes back by God, and God is sitting up there and so forth, by world which is the constant presence of divinity. God is continuously creating the world. God continuously sending his effusion, his faith, his barakah, his grace, his presence into the world. And that we are called by God to be Khalifatullah fil ard. That is, the same way that God preserves his creation as his vicegerents, we have the same function and the same duty. It's a very, very heavy task, especially because we're placed in a world in which the forgetting of God is so easy. Means of knowing and production, that is modern science and technology, are based on a secularized worldview, and we feel that we cannot do without it. And in practice, I know fully well that no matter what I say, they're not going to stop all the trains in Pakistan so that they get back on Camelback and to go. Of course, if they did that, there'd be a lot less bombing in Pakistan, but that's not going to happen. I'm just giving the poor Pakistanis as an example. Things like that are everywhere. That's not going to happen, but we have to start with principles. Everything that I'm telling you is that I believe has to be understood by those people have the intelligentsia who themselves would then teach it to a wider audience. It always seems to be such a hopeless task to rechange the view of the world. But I always say, look at this example. If you were living in, let's say, 1670, 1680 in Europe, there were no more than 50 people who accepted the Galilean Newtonian science and cosmology. No more than 50, 60 people. But just in two, three countries, in Great Britain, France, and Germany, maybe a couple of people in Holland, they used to write to each other, could assemble them all in one room. And within one century, that mechanistic worldview and mechanistic cosmology came to dominate over whole of Western Europe. So it's not a question of quantity. The process cannot begin with quantity. On the level of quantity, the best that we can do is to try to promulgate the Sharia in such a way that at least less harm is done to the environment. But deeper down, there's no possible way of solving the environmental crisis by Muslims than something very radical, which is the rejection of the paradigm of modern science. Not the rejection of what modern science has discovered, but what it assumes to be, the scientism, what the scientific myth that goes with science. Its rejection and substitution of that with an Islamic worldview. I've worked for 50 years on this matter. One of my recent books is called Islam, Science, Muslims, and Technology. It's a virulent attack against ourselves, against the shoddy thinking or unthinking or half-thinking of so many Muslims and Muslim governments when it comes to these issues. Look at in Iran. Yes, in Iran there are a lot of very fine scientists, very fine engineers. But the Iranian television, its great pride from morning to night, is how somebody has invented a new cell or discovered a new germ or something like that. This is the Islamic Republic of Iran. Nothing has ever said about religion, about spirituality, except during Muharram or something like that. But the great pride of society is in developing a science which is not Islamic. And to say just science is total nonsense. Every science is based on a worldview. And that worldview of modern science is not the Islamic worldview. You can be a very good scientist and be a believer in God, and you can be a very good scientist and do not believe in God, which means the belief in God is irrelevant to whether you're a scientist or not. The divinity is totally irrelevant to modern physics. Many people in the West now are trying to change the philosophy of Western science, but for us Muslims, to talk about the environment, to talk about nature, first of all, must be able to present the Islamic answer to a worldview which has now become global, which is taken for granted, and everybody is trying to make use of it and trying to make use of the technology which follows from it. It would, theoretically, of course, you could have had modern science without modern technology, but that's only theoretically, because there was power, as Francis Bacon said, which helped modern science develop and get the money to do new things, and that power expected to receive power. And therefore, even today, half the research fund of MIT comes from the military, and many other universities the same. So the fact that we do have this technology is something which is tied completely to a scientific worldview, which Muslims have been too lazy to really understand and to criticize from the Islamic point of view. And therefore, the environmental crisis is always looked upon as a kind of unfortunate consequence of a process that itself is wonderful. That's false. That's false. Why do we have 9 billion people by 2050 on the surface of the earth? We will have if we don't kill ourselves. We've destroyed the balance of nature that is based on a medicine which is wonderful at a certain level, but which has also terrible consequences by the fact that people don't die normally and we have the situation that we have. And the environmental crisis, to a large extent, not completely, of course, is caused by the environment, by overpopulation. Now, human nature is such that its confidence in things Sheikhs put it easily. Today, everybody is very, very confident of modern technology, including Muslims. And most people think that you can solve technological problems with the help of more technology. I've heard that sentence 1,000 times on every continent. I wonder what the people near the reactors in Japan are thinking now. Japan was a country which, more than any Asian country, sought to emulate Western technology and science. I was the most successful at it. China just coming up now, but for during the last century. And paradoxically, it's the only Asian country to have had an atomic bomb thrown on it and to have had a major environmental disaster based on atomic waste and radiation that we're observing now. Things are much, much more difficult in Japan than you read about. A lot of things are hidden. All the water pumped into the Pacific Ocean full of radiation. What happened to all the fish? They don't have a conference at the UN to be able to complain. It's a catastrophic situation, catastrophic situation. And a few more catastrophes might help us. Once someone asked me, I said, you seem to be very pessimistic about things. What would be the best solution, do you think, to this crisis? I said a minor crisis that would kill 50, 60 million people. So what? I said, I'm not in Bhopal, in Detroit, or in Germany. Nobody cared in the United States when 5,000 people died of an industrial accident in Bhopal. Who cared? Nobody. But anything less than that, people think, oh, well, this was just one accident, let's go back and do the same thing again. Now, the non-Western countries are not only trying to copy what this Western method of dealing with technology is, but even copying its mistakes. We're already copying the mistakes of the West. That is, even things which 40, 50 years ago were done, which now many people in the West realize should not be done, we're now beginning to do in many Islamic countries with the pretext that we don't have enough money. In the long run, look at the 5 centuries. Which would be better? To have the camel caravans still continue from Marrakesh to the Sudan, but they still do, part of the world which hasn't changed very much? Or to have rapid electric trains in the middle of the Sahara, with the devastation of all of life and the destruction of all of the ecology? Which would be better? If you're a minister of industry, you would say, of course, the second, let's have the electric train. But we are not ministers of industry. I'm talking at Yale University, a university that was created by Lehud Yale in order to be more religious than Harvard. So that's why I should not be allowed at this university. But I've sent several very good PhD students. When I said, you're going to Yale, my God, everything must be falling apart. I said, well, I don't agree with the secularism of my own institution so much. Yale is symbolic of this. It's the idea that to have good education, you have to have something of a spiritual, religious nature. This is something that this university has always stood up for, and it's here. You students have been trained here, that you must learn not to look at immediate expediency. You must be able to have a far-sighted vision. If we don't have that in universities, who's going to have it? The politicians who make laws just to get elected next year, people who deny global warming so that some people in Iowa would vote for them. That's not unique to the Islamic world. Or such and such a leader in Tunisia or Egypt or Iran or Pakistan, it doesn't matter where, who's thinking of only a power, and if he's a good ruler, I want how to feed the people in Baluchistan where there's been a shortage of water or something like that. But who does the long-term thinking? Long-term thinking can only come from people who are thinkers, whom God has given the intelligence and the occasion to study something in depth. And I believe that this last 20, 30 years, I've talked a great deal about the environment, but mostly in a cosmetic fashion, should really come to an end. Those who really understand what's happening to the world, to the environment, must really stand up. Stand up and show how drastic the changes that we need to make really are. Why we have to use less energy. Why is it we have to change certain habits? Why is it the Super Bowl uses more energy than the energy used by many African countries for a whole month? Just one day of Super Bowl in the United States. What do these things mean? Why are we committing mass suicide? And the Islamic world is caught in a larger world. But at least we can start cleaning up our own house. And I think that will not be possible without intelligence, without iman, faith, without bravery, and most of all, the tawfiq min Allah. Thank you.